It's against the law. What are you talking about, what basis? You're not allowed to bribe someone to vote or not to vote. Both are working? Okay, let's roll. Today is January 21st, 2013. Am I right? Believe me, it's confusing. No, 2014 and when I'm giving Divrei Musa, but it's 2013 in reality. Okay, it's Monday morning, and I once again want to say hello to the students in front of me and to the many that are listening across the wide expanse of the big world. I just want to mention that we had spoken about the Ritbaz, and I spoke at the end when the Ritbaz went to Israel, or Palestine at the time. He was the big Baal Plukta with Rav Kook on the Shnat HaShmitah issue in the early 1900s. So a Talmud got in touch with me. It was my Talmud, in the 70s, and he listens to all the Shurim, Gerald Porat and Gavriel or Gerald Porat, and his grandfather, Rav Yisrael Porat, who was Palestinian Bamakar, later winds up in Cleveland for a lifetime, was a mismach of both Rav Kook and the Ritbaz, so that his Zeta was able to combine both worlds. I also want to mention that Dr. Blau, who was in class a few weeks ago, once again tells me that although he knows the son of the Landau who wrote the book on RJJ, and he's close to Satman, he works for Satman, he's one of their main psychologists, nevertheless, you can't convince them of the truth. Quote, having the proper hashkafah of the period is more important to them than getting all the actual facts correct, especially if the correct actual facts serve to undermine their predetermined proper hashkafa. So I just want to tell Rabbi Brau, I appreciate his words and I understand what he's saying. I'll come back to just one area of my critique later today. Now, we're dealing here with what happened with a very important class today. I understand what happened. It's a little over 100 years ago already. The Eitz Chaim was functioning. It was not exactly an elementary yeshiva. We don't know for sure how it worked, but our educated scholarly guesses on the basis of the period and what's been written and the memoir literature is that it evidently was the equivalent of 7th, 8th grade, perhaps some high school years. Kids studied Chumash, kids studied Mishnah, those who could studied already Gemara, and they had some general classes. In 1897, and also it's a gradual development, Rabbi Matlin, who had come to be an RJJ based in, had a son, Akiva. And as we said last week, he wanted Akiva to continue learning Gemara. How do you get a kid to learn Gemara who, after all, is going to high school? He's the end of the day, he comes home, he wants to play, wants to be like any other kid. And he told Akiva, bring some of your friends. And friends brought friends, and before you know it, they went into a synagogue. And in 1897, they were incorporated, and as I explained last week, they took the name Yeshivas Rabbein Yitzchak Chanan, because Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan had just died, and he was revered by the Lithuanian Jews in America. We explained last week, he was a great posek, the Mati Ragunot, and this was Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan. Now, the school continued to grow. Students are coming in from Europe, and it's the old question. Israel has faced this question time and again. When I came in Aliyah, we went into an absorption center. Charlie, when you came, also absorption centers, you had housing there. Yitzchak, when you came, was there you went into an absorption center? Okay, so you were Mekas Kitabav Sever, I was in Mekas Kitabav Katamontet. And the whole concept of an absorption center was to allow a person to make the initial adjustment with safeguards around him. In other words, not to throw you into the brunt of Israeli life, a language you don't speak, a mentality you don't understand, and so much is happening around you, and like to provide a halfway house. It's someone coming out of jail, as I said last week, pardon the comparison, but that's a halfway house. I remember when Meir Kahana was in Manhattan in a halfway house, and he wandered into Kilat Jeshurun one Shabbos. It's a famous story. I've heard the story both from Meir Hashem Yikom Damo, and I heard the story Badal Chaim Aruchim Tovim from Haki Lichtstein as well. I heard it on both ends. So that was the concept. Today, Israel does not work with a absorption center, does not work with a halfway house. The idea is that you're absorbed by your friends who came before you. They help you out. There's no greater example than Nefesh B'Nefesh, which has worked so successfully with the Anglo immigration, to a certain degree with the French immigration, has a Nefesh B'Nefesh grant, if I'm not mistaken. But this was the whole problem, that these kids came to America, and some of them already were teenagers, late teenagers. In Europe, they sat and learned. They knew how to learn a Daf Gemara. They knew what happened up the Shulchan Aruch. They knew how to Paskin. And here in America, what do you do? And they gravitated towards Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Hanan. They're now in a shul. They have room. They have Sheyurim. But these kids also sense the need to Americanize. And of course, how do you Americanize? You have to learn the language, you have to have general culture, what we call in Israel Tachnut HaLibah. In English, they gave it a translation, core curriculum. I don't know in America whether they use that word. I don't know in America whether the term exists at all, because every school teaches a kid arithmetic and the English language and how to read. And the core curriculum is axiomatic to American education. But these young people wanted a core curriculum, and tension develops. And this is where we left off last week, because who was supporting the yeshiva? Balabatim are supporting the yeshiva, and when Balabatim support the yeshiva, they view it as Zvulun and Yisachar. They are the Zvulun, and they want Yisachar to sit and learn. You're not going to get any reward. The whole question, when you study mathematics or study English literature, or you study computers, do you make a bracha? Hashem b'mitzvatav etzivanu al limud machshavim. Right, we don't make a bracha. It's an interesting question. How do we relate to general subjects? But one thing is for sure, that the East Side individual who runs a store and can just speak a broken English, enough English to get by and make a few dollars, he feels bad that he's not learning. And he wants the kid learning in Reeds to sit and learn for him. And the Balabatam, and this is where I was upset with this volume by Yonah Landau, by the Sakma, who wrote a volume on RJJ, Rav HaKolel, his description of the period is totally incorrect. He describes the students being against general studies, and the administration of the yeshiva forcing them to, God forbid, have a high school and later it becomes a college. And when he writes about Rabbi Revel, it's shocking that you can put it all into print. It has no basis in reality. But as Dr. Blau said, Rebbe, you're fighting a losing battle when you're trying to convince, a Satma that the facts are facts and follow the truth, not the fairy tales. What got me extremely agitated, and we'll come back later today, is that Jacob Schiff gave some money. Well, what are you getting upset, Steve? Why do you defend Satma suddenly? Suddenly, Rabbi Rubin, I'm not tolerating it. Please, that he called Jacob Schiff, Rabbi Yankel Schiff, because he gave $1,000. The man was president of Temple Emmanuel, the leader of the late leader of the Reform movement, but for $1,000, suddenly a Satmar guy calls him Reb Yaakov Schiff. And if you call him Reb Yaakov Schiff, you have another problem. There is a Reb Yaakov Schiff. No, tell me who Reb Yaakov Schiff is. Rabbi Reuben, who is Reb Yaakov Schiff? The Reb Aaron Cutler's Talmud Mufak from America. At Kahat Yudah Peyasha, his American Talmud Mufak is a Bronx boy, Yankala Shiv. Who is he married to? No? Help me out, the Priska Rebbe's daughter. Please, you, the guy, you'll do research, and what's the difference? They're 100 years apart, but when you do Satmar research, 100 years blends into two, and you'll have Rabbi Yankala Shiv already. Anyway, that got me upset, but the Rabbi Rubin is entitled to feel for $1,000, call him Rabbi Yankala Shiv. The truth is, as given a shtickle, Rabbi Yankala Shiv, he was mixed up. Okay. Now, what was happening in YU was the students really wanted to broaden. And here, we owe a great debt of gratitude to Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman. On whose shoulders I stood when I did my doctorate, because he comes up with an unbelievable little story that happened in 1907. And I just want to elaborate, because this story is a forerunner for what I later in my doctorate, I have an entire chapter on it. And in postdoctoral research, one of my most important pieces of postdoctoral research is on this very topic as well. It appears today in Rakaf et Ara, I think it's Chelik Bet. It originally appeared in Tel Aviv University, a publication called Michoel, but Michael. But no one sees it there. It was a Favofana publication, but it's in Rakaf et Ara. What happened at the yeshiva? You had some fairly bright fellows, and he identifies three of them, although one, we don't know who he is. He didn't know. I'm standing on Rabbi Klapman's shoulders now. This is his research. Rabbi Wolf, we have no idea who that is. But Rabbi David Rackman and Rabbi Nachman Eben, we absolutely know who they are. Rabbi Nachman Eben, there's a David Eben today, Rabbi David Eben in Chinuch. That's either a grandson or a great-grandson. You can check it out. He's married to Rabbi Teitz's daughter. Specific Shani, for him, I think it's specific Shlishi, for her specific Shani. And a wonderful individual. Anyone know him? I believe he teaches in a yeshiva in Katamon. There's a yeshiva for foreign students. I believe he is on that faculty, maybe one of the founders of that yeshiva. He taught many years with Rabbi Riskin, but I don't believe he teaches in Rabbi Riskin's institutions anymore. Now, Rabbi David Rackman, you certainly should recognize, he is the father of Rabbi Emanuel Rackman. And here are three students, Yudah Peyasha, Talmidei Chachamim. They wind up on the east side, and they want to Americanize, they want to broaden. Do you know who they go to? They go to visit Dr. Professor Rabbi, give him any title you want, he has them all, Solomon Schechter at JTS. Why do they not now? Here already you come, see, this opens a Pandora's box. When you think in terms of JTS today, what are these, Rabbi Rackman's father, Rabbi David Rackman became an apikoros? Rabbi Nachman Eben became an apikoros? You go to JTS. But you see, you have to put JTS into context. 1907, JTS was nominally an Orthodox institution. As you know from my lectures of years ago,
what year did
JTS open? JTS opens 1887. As you know from my lectures of years ago, when JTS opened, it opened in contradistinction to the Reform Movement. The Treifa Dinner, 1883, Cincinnati, is legendary. And remember, all the rabbis were invited. No one knew what Hebrew Union College was yet. We'll come to that in the Sunday class next week. I'll show you something. It'll blow your minds. But this is reality. Life, if I wrote fiction, no one would believe it. But these are facts. And JTS did not use the word Orthodox in its charter simply to attract money from beyond the narrow Orthodox confines. But if you read the charter of JTS, it talks about loyalty to Torah Shebichtav and loyalty to Torah Shebaal Peh. And there's no question that JTS was established to be a counterforce to Hebrew Union College. Now, what happened with JTS was it didn't really enjoy success. Why? And this is something we're going to come back to and I'll give you sources. But why didn't enjoy success? Because who is their target audience? You're producing rabbis. Rabbis for the assimilated German Jews, they don't want JTS. Hebrew Union College is fine. The Eastern European masses on the east side of New York, and they now are Americanizing to a certain degree, but they look at a JTS rabbi, and I'll give you quotes, but I don't want to get, it's not important now to give you exact sources, but the Yiddish Tageblatt, the newspapers, they look at a JTS rabbi, I'll quote to you what the Yiddish Tageblatt said. In Europe, we learned an entire Masechet in 4 or 5 months. This is a rabbi that he learned half of Masechet Megillah in a full year. Half of Masechet Tainut took him a full year. In other words, they laughed at these rabbis. And JTS turned out, to take an example, the most famous rabbi they turned out, is that your relationship, Rabbi Joseph Hertz? Okay, now you can't claim it, okay? I have big yichus, and I'm not claiming it. I found it out, but 48 years after, I should have known my yichus. But Rabbi Hertz was a JTS graduate. So you hear Abaron Soloveitchik. I was just listening to Abaron last week in two talks he gave on Torah Umada in the 1980s and YU. Fabulous talks. I checked with upstairs where they're working on the YU website, Robert Shure told me that he has the talks they're going to put on. There's going to be a big celebration one day down the line. A few thousand talks of Abaron Soloveitchik are going to go on the YU website, and included will be these two talks. So in the talk, Abaron talks about Rabbi Hertz, and he says, I quote him, he says, Rabbi Hertz was not a gadol hadar learning, but he was a real frum Jew. And he quotes from his commentary on the Chumash how he refused to accept Darwin. He said that it simply denigrates the greatness of a human being. Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem Elokim. All right, I don't know whether we have to push Darwin away. You can always say there's a prime force. But I saw Rav Aaron has such derech eretz for Joseph Hertz, the chief Rabbi Hertz of England. And the truth is, you see the family, his son-in-law was Rabbi Dr. Victor Schoenfeld, Einik Lacharedi, Charedim, Kanain Hara. You got to give credit. He was a graduate of the seminary. But an East European Jew in 1890, in 1900, looked at Rabbi Hertz, Vifu Gemara Kenner. Can he give his shir? Can he give his shir in Shas and Paiskim? Why does he know in Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch? You understand? So JTS was not succeeding. Now we come back to Satmar again. JTS would have been written off the map. It would have disappeared. I visited JTS in 1901. Windows were broken. They didn't have money to fix the windows. Rabbi Hertz, I'm not putting you on. Memoir literature. You were there. Windows were broken. Aye. So they saw that they have no way to continue. What are they going to do? So they held a meeting, and you had a balabas like Jacob Schiff, or as Satmar calls him, Reb Yaakov Schiff. Okay? Now, Jacob Schiff, you have to understand, was a split personality. He had been raised on the lap of Reb Shimshon Afoel Hirsch. He was an enekel of the Maram Schiff, and he knew what Yiddishkeit was. And he, by the way, you should know, was an observant Jew. I mean, it's so difficult for us to comprehend as the president of Temple Emanuel. When he had Yartzeit, he went down to the Beis Medrash HaGadol on the east side. Outside the Beis Medrash, there was his chariot with the horses, whatever drove him down there with his driver with, you know, we're talking about a multi-billionaire. This is not lightweight. You got to understand, this is Shanghai. The Shanghai, now that everyone researches Shanghai, it turns out that part of Japan's tolerant attitude towards the Jews, that they saved Torah, that the Japanese people, simple Sugihara, the Japanese people saved Torah. I'm sitting here because of Japan. So why? Ah, who lent money to Japan to fight the Russo-Japanese War? Jacob Schiff. And Jacob Schiff did it to, of course, he hated Russia because of the pogroms that they tolerated against the Jews. I mean, it's unbelievable. So Jacob Schiff had feeling. So Jacob Schiff said, I'll summarize his words. Jacob Schiff said, or Rabbi Yankel Schiff, call him what you wish now. He said, look, I grew up in Rav Hirsch's court. Today I'm president of Temple Emmanuel. But we must have, I'm now using his term, we must have an enlightened orthodoxy, end quote, in the United States. And he put up heavy money to bring Solomon Schechter to America. Now, without going into great detail, Solomon Schechter, again, you have to understand his name, Rav Shneur Zalman Schechter. What does it tell you? It tells you two things. He came from a Chabad house, Shneur Zalman, and his father was a Shechet. That's how they got the name Solomon Schechter. And if I'm not mistaken, his father was one of the Shechtim that the Shevel Umeshiv trusted. He was one of the Lemberger's Rav's Shechtim, top quality. Solomon Schechter, Skivana Chedi Yingel, he was a normal Hasidish, a little kid. And then he broadened. He wound up in England. And here, again, I'm very brief. I've spoken about this in great detail. Here, he was in England. It was all right. He had a university position. No one knew his name. But rumors began to spread that there's the Cairo Geniza. There was a word timer from the Yishuv HaYashan in Yerushalayim. I yet knew his great-granddaughter. He went down to Cairo and he started taking out some of the treasures. Then Hatzich Gemonin, he remembered he has a Simcha in Yerushalayim, there's a Kiddush, a Feisvas. He comes back and he, I go today, I go tomorrow, whatever it is. The word went out. And had he emptied out the Cairo Geniza, there would have never been a conservative Judaism in America today. But because he was a Batlan, and he came out, and the word went out, so Schechter raised money in England. He and his assistant, Taylor, went to Cairo, and they didn't leave. You can check the exact figure. I think it was 157 donkeys. On either side of the donkey were bags, leather bags, with manuscripts, with parchment that they pulled out of the Geniza. And he got to the boat, he paid bakshish, he bribed his way, gave the Gabaya money, Fushtat, it was a suburb of Cairo, and that he took to Cambridge, and he became world famous. Everyone knew about Professor Schechter, the man who discovered the Geniza, the man who identified manuscripts of Maimonides, of Reb Shlomo Alkabetz, of Reb Yosef Karo, of Reb Yehuda Halevi, etc., etc. So now they looked for someone to reorganize the seminary. Where are we going to find this enlightened orthodoxy? And they brought Solomon Schechter to America. Okay, now there's another factor, and bear this in mind. We've spoken about this many times. Some of you know that when I began my shiurim on Reb Shaul Berlin, Reb Shaul Levine on the Samim Rosh, so I quoted to you a Zohar, Hakol Talui B'mazel, Afilu Sefer Torah Shebeheichal. And I've said I've seen enough of life to know there are three aspects to life. The right man in the right place at the right time. Many times you can be the right man, but you're in the wrong place. Many times you're in the right place, but it's the wrong time. Many times you can be a nice flop, a trumpenik, an idiot, an amarid, a boor, and any urechei, but you're in the right place at the right time, and suddenly he's the biggest rabbi around, etc., etc. And it's very rare to be the right man in the right place at the right time, is a matana min hashemayim. And I personally, ani modela kadosh baruch hu, because I was, when I came in Aliyah, the right person in the right place at the right time. I shiver. That BMT should be organized 1969, that Rakefet, a little kid from the Bronx, should come in Aliyah 1969, and that we all coalesce right here, B'Yerushalayim, Mir HaKodesh. So, Min Daf Tankpazani, Modal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, but now Solomon Schechter is in the right place. The right time. What do I mean by that? Because these East European immigrants have children. Children don't remain children that long. When you have your firstborn child, and I know the feeling, and it's a normal feeling, you can't believe, you know, always the little clothes and the diapers and the rattle and the whatever. And boy, do those kids grow big. And you know, a kid that worships, it's his father, his mother. By the time the kid is already 12, 13, he's telling you off, right or wrong. By the time the kid is 15, 16, he knows more than his parents. Later in life, when he turns 30, the kid suddenly says to his father, gee, Dad, did you learn a lot? I now respect you. I don't know, 2 years ago I thought you knew nothing. In these 2 years, you managed 30 years of knowledge. They're having kids. The kids are Americanizing. Now, these kids can't walk into a Reform temple. They're not at home in the Reform temple. But they don't need already a Rav that knows Shas and Paiskim, because the kid, all right, he reads Hebrew, he reads Yiddish, and Eret Yiddish. He knows maybe how to read a Pasuk Chumash, but this kid already is not his father. And the seminary now has fertile ground on which to grow. Follow me? Solomon Schechter, had they brought him to America 1883, he would have been the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time. 1902, he is Mr. Right. Now, the seminary starts to expand. So these kids, again, Rabbi Klapman makes it clear in his research, we don't know what their motives were. But let me tell you, it was a good shtick to pull. If we can't have general studies in REITs, we are going to the seminary. Now, you've got to understand the seminary's curriculum. And why? Yeah, what do you want to ask? No, these people already are like 1920, the Europäische Talmidei Chachamim. High school age and older. I explained last week already, there was a Beis Medrash in Gesitzt and Geladent. But they wanted classes in core curriculum. Now, the seminary, and here you come to an interesting facet. The word seminary, whoever heard of a seminary? The fact that it's called Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary is a bad term. It should be called, in English, Yeshivat Rabbi Isaac Elchanan, period. We're not a theological seminary. YU, more or less, is a real yeshiva. What's a real yeshiva? You sit and learn. I came into YU on Sunday morning. The Sunday morning I was going to speak. So first of all, I was very impressed. The Beis Medrash was filled. In my time on a Sunday morning, unless Mr. Abrams went on a tear to take attendance, which he had George Finkelstein. Now, could you imagine what we're talking about? Take attendance. The Beis Medrash was empty. Everyone worked on Sunday morning. We all taught Talmud Torah. Anyone who's studying for Smicha had to make a living. You had to get married. It's not today. You're spoon-fed, and you have four or five different kailalim. Those days, you had to work. Who was there Sunday morning? But I come into the Beis Medrash. Everyone's learning. It's a yeshiva. The shiur first is, on Sunday morning, it's not a full day. So the shiur, if I spoke at 10:30, I believe that the shiur was first 11 o'clock. Rabbi Heschel Schechter, Rabbi Mordi, whoever was in the Beis Medrash, when giving shiur, I think the shiur was 11 o'clock. But that's a yeshiva. A real yeshiva, you don't even have a smicha, don't have a program of study, that's something you do privately. A yeshiva's role is to sit and learn, undisciplined. Ah, but with the modern world, we came out of the ghetto. Came out of the ghetto, we become pragmatic, utilitarian. We cannot tolerate the haphazard, the zullerly lifestyle of the past. So what do you have beginning in Germany, later in Hungary? Ultimately, they even try to do it, the Tsar tries to do it in greater Russia. You have a seminary, a theological seminary. What is a theological seminary? Structured, a program of study. You have more than Talmud, and Mishnah, and Bible, and homiletics, and pedagogy, and Jewish history, and Jewish philosophy, and you have exams, and you have 4 years, and then you're ordained. Now, you know what's fascinating about the seminaries? No seminary had any secular studies. Absolutely not. A seminary is for Judaic studies in a scientific method, in an organized method. You don't get ordination until you have a PhD. Where do you get the PhD? At a neighboring university. Very interesting point of view. It's like the yeshiva that have sprang up in you understand, with the tuition problem. So you have, for instance, Madregat HaAdam in Queens. You go to yeshiva, and you go to any university you want. Shai Yashub, I see their advertisements, Far Rockaway. Our program is designed so that you can do your college studies in the early afternoon. You don't have to go to night anymore, like in my time, all the Chaim Berlin boys, all the Torah Vadas boys went at night when they were half asleep. That's when they became medical doctors, world famous lawyers. Imagine had they been awake, they would have solved every medical problem imaginable. But not in the yeshiva. There was not one theological seminary. And by the way, there was a very famous Orthodox theological seminary, Hildesheimer, Germany. All the Yekesher Rabbanim, a good deal of the Hungarian Rabbanim. We spoke last week about Rabbi Hillel Klein. They were all products of Hildesheimer. Where did they get their doctorates? At a neighboring university. JTS was exactly modeled after a seminary. It was not a yeshiva. It was modeled after a rabbinic seminary, German style, to a certain degree, like Hildesheimer, which was organized in 1873 in Berlin. And you had to have a university degree to be accepted into the rabbinic program. That university degree you got elsewhere. And all of you know that until today, Columbia University has a working relationship with JTS, and I've already had a student 2 years ago right here in the Kollel who was a graduate of JTS and a graduate of Columbia University. And it's an interrelated program, but the core curriculum is at the university. The Limudei Kodesh are at the seminary. So Solomon Schechter explained to these three young men that he cannot accept them because they don't have college degrees and he cannot help them. But he was very kind to them. Who did he bring into the discussion? And once again, we can't escape his name. Jacob Schiff / Reb Yankala Schiff. Now, look at the way Rabbi Klapperman describes him in contradistinction to Yonah Landau. I quote Rabbi Klapperman. Jacob Beit Schiff was one of the Jewish Theological Seminary's most generous benefactors, a descendant of a line of rabbis, tolerant of orthodoxy, and most interested in Jewish education. All right? That's a much more honest description without turning him into a tzaddik at that moment in time. Jacob Schiff met with them. And as a result, he became a benefactor of the yeshiva. And he gave Rietz $1,000 a year. Now, I'm not saying he gave Reitz what he gave JTS, obviously not. I'm not saying he gave Reitz what he gave Hebrew Union College. But translate $1,000 1907 money to what that money is worth today in 2013. Just think for one moment. $1,000 a year. Who became very friendly with JTS? With Jacob Schiff? Who became very friendly? One of the earliest Orthodox Jews who came to America, an absolute impoverished immigrant, who was met at the boat by his relatives, who signaled him, take your yarmulke off. The yarmulke was left in Europe. This was a Jew who was fired from work every Monday because he didn't come in Shabbos. And finally, he decided to work Shabbos. We know all this. His son-in-law wrote a beautiful memoir for his father-in-law. We're very much in debt to him. We'll talk about him in great detail. And the Shabbos, he decided to work. Like I remember from the Bronx in which I grew up, he davened at the 6:30 minyan. He went home, changed, made kiddush, ate something, changed in his work clothes, and started to go to work. And walking to work, he saw Jews going to daven. And he saw a bearded Jew and a woman with her head covered, and he thought he saw his parents that he had left behind in Mezrich. And he couldn't go to work. He turned around and he went home. And he never worked on Shabbos. And he went on to become Harry Fishel. And Harry Fishel now was on a level to be friendly with Jacob Schiff. And he was the contact from the yeshiva to Jacob Schiff, bringing in $1,000 a year. Now, Brackman and Eben came back to the yeshiva. No one seems to know who this Wolf was. It could be a first name, it could be a last name. Rabbi Klapman could not solve that problem. Again, when you do research, you're dependent upon archival material, you're dependent upon what remains. Nowadays, if something is in Google, if you can find material, you're set. If you can't find material, you choke. And Rabbi Eben, Rabbi Rachman came back to yeshiva. Rabbi Eben goes into the rabbinate, goes into chinuch. Rabbi Rachman evidently played with the rabbinate and then reached the conclusion that unfortunately many rabbis reach, that being a businessman and independent is much better than being a rabbi subject to Jews. And you understand, I'm Sheyorov, I don't have to go any further than the present election. It defies imagination. The Satmar Rebbe comes in to tell people not to vote. He's costing a good 1 to 2 seats every election, but this is worse than ever because he came in person. And as a result, it could very well be that within the year, thousands of agudistim will be wearing an army uniform in addition to having beard and payas and gatel and tzitzit sticking out, etc. And it's all the Satmar Rebbe. It's beyond words. And these are Jews, let alone Rav Ovadia honored me by calling me a goy Saturday night. Okay, we got a lot of going. We'll find out just how many when the results come in on Wednesday. But etc., etc. Gentlemen, a rabbi becomes a businessman. Knew what happened to Rabbi David Rachman. Do you know the story? Went up to Albany, I believe it was, upstate New York, opened up what we call a makolet, a grocery, an oversized grocery store. Gentiles used to line up outside the store Saturday night because they knew he would open after Shabbat ended. He was the most honest, had the most fabulous reputation, and he went on to become a wealthy businessman. That was Rabbi David Rachman. Now, food for thought, imagine had Solomon Schechter accepted them. Just think, He opens a channel. Top students of REITs. The seminary will give you a core curriculum. Who needs REITs? And I want to tell you, this repeats itself in the mid-20s as well. And I'll be very brief now. In the future, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll go into more detail. But I just want to tie it all together. In the mid-20s, Yeshiva announces a $5 million campaign. Again, think in terms of today's money, like $5 billion to build the campus in Washington Heights. No, you have the seminary. They're struggling. They moved to 122nd Street and Broadway. Many Balabatim raised the issue, why do we need two institutions? What's so different between them? 1920s, REITs is Shomer Shabbos and JTS is Shomer Shabbos. REITs is Shomer Kashrut, JTS is Shomer Kashrut. And Tarat Mishpacha, who argues? All right, many shuls don't have a mechitza. You know how many YU graduates took shuls without mechitzat? Come on. I can tell you, in my time, I told you, they asked you one question. Will you take your shul without a mechitza? And many, you got a chet or whatever. You know, some of them changed it. God forbid, I'm not being negative. Some of them became good conservative rabbis. In their own personal life, they were totally observant. We all know names we can mention. I once was standing in a very affluent community, and they show me that's the rabbi of the conservative temple coming. And he's walking, and his children are coming for came in from Israel to visit him. The kids, oh, with their tzitzit out. some of them had chelet tzitzit that we spoke about yesterday. And he was there, why are you graduate rabbi of the temple? The kids, I taught so many in the Kollel whose fathers were prominent conservative rabbis from kids. So you see, the lack of a mechitza would not have been such a big impediment. And had the merchantmen pulled off, the Balabatim would have been ecstatic because one institution to support, money is money. I mean, you know what we're going through with tuition problems in America. Money is money. But with all the attempt made to merge, there was one problem they couldn't overcome. And that problem changed the course of American Torah history. Mordechai Kaplan. Mordechai Kaplan, the problem could not be solved. Mordechai Kaplan, father of Yisrael Kaplan, based in of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Mordechai Kaplan, a student at Eitz Chaim, a student at Dreitz, a bright individual. The assistant, the English-speaking rabbi in Kehilat Jeshurun. Do you know what Kehilat Jeshurun is? You saw at the Kotel Friday night, everyone's looking. They figured Rakevet is changing the world. You saw, sitting here is Rabbi Haki Lukstein. Sitting here is Richard Joel. I'm in the middle. We're changing the world. We were crying with the problems that we have. We weren't changing anything. We don't even know how to solve the problems. But Rabbi Lukstein, KJ, here, a little guy from the Bronx who eulogized Stan Musial yesterday, to his right is the most prominent Orthodox rabbi in the Western Hemisphere, and to his left is the president of the largest institution of modern Orthodoxy in the world. Wow. Gentlemen, Mordechai Kaplan, English-speaking assistant to Ramaz, will come to Ramaz today, I hope. What a speaker. You didn't know Mordechai Kaplan. I did. Personally. He lived right near BMT, where BMT began, right off Rehov Abarbanel. Once gave him a lift in my car. He tried to show me he's wearing fringes. I said, yes, Professor Kaplan, I know. You can sit. And he took his fringes out. I remember like this. See? I also am wearing fringes. And I said, yes, I understand. For you, it's a civilization. All right, I didn't want to argue with him. For me, it's the Baha Hashem. But what do you do with Mordechai Kaplan? And I want to say, to the credit of Mordechai Kaplan, he was asked, You know, he started writing articles in 1919, 1920, that there was no Matan Torah, that God may be, may not be, God is unimportant, civilization. And they asked him, Professor Kaplan, how long have you had these thoughts? He says, for years. Why didn't you publicize it? Why did we hire you thinking you were an Orthodox rabbi? He said, I didn't want to hurt my parents. Got to give a guy credit. Kolzman, his parents were alive. He did not popularize his apikorset. But this is an interesting chapter or two in the history of Torah in America, how twice JTS had the chance to absorb Reitz, and both times it failed. In 1907, you got to give Solomon Schacht the credit. He called in Jacob Schiff. He viewed these guys as immigrants, greenhorns. Solomon Schechter, on principle, did not like to speak Yiddish. We're Americans. We have to speak English. He Americanized. Solomon Schechter spoke at a graduation and made that famous statement that if our graduates of JTS do not understand baseball, they will not have success in the American rabbinate. All right? I don't believe that Reb David Lifshitz ever said that. I don't believe that Reb Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lessen ever said that. The Rav already said it. That's a different story. But Solomon Schechter Americanized. He looked at them greenhorns. Menet Yiddish, men Lenin Lachin Yiddish, what geht on? He didn't help, but he brought in Jacob Schiff. Years later, 20 years later, when there were very serious negotiations, they couldn't solve the problem of Mordechai Kaplan. Had they been able to get rid of Mordechai Kaplan, it would have been a different history. But Mordechai Kaplan had detractors and supporters. And some of the supporters, one of the Lamport family, were big heavyweight people. And you didn't push around Mordechai Kaplan because millions of dollars stood behind him. And unfortunately, money speaks and rekefet walks. And this is a reality of life. Okay. Gentlemen, what happened in the yeshiva is very fascinating. 1906, what I just told you about happened in 1907. And again, I cite to you Gil Klapman's research, although I have to be honest, a lot of this was oral history in the yeshiva. When I came in 51, there were still people alive who spoke about what happened. And 1906... there was a minor strike of students. 1908, a major, major strike. The students exploded. Why? Because the Balabata made promises, core curriculum, teachers, textbooks, and the promises were either totally discarded or kept in a very desolatory, unprofessional method. Let me quote to you, this is from 1906, when the students issued a statement that was picked up by the Yiddish press. And you have to understand, today you're living in the world of websites, blogs. I don't have to tell you how many battles have been fought, what students do when they have grievances, when people are angry. You all know the computer today rules us. Newspapers had that power. Students went to the newspapers, and remember, people who publish newspapers want to sell them. They have to make money. They have to keep afloat. They have to pay salaries. When you have machloket, newspapers jump on it, kimotze shalol rav. It's like some of the websites. I'll give you the other, Failed Messiah. You ever look at Failed Messiah? Any garbage that they can dig up. But it's fabulous. People are interested. People are complaining. People are writing letters. There's one, I think it's called Bolam Shel Charedim. I know the guy who runs it. I know him too well. Chaim Schulzer. You recognize the name? You go to that website. Any machloiket in the Haredi world appears there in all its glory. Colored pictures, posters, paskvilas. a video of the Satmar Rebbe. Today you can see a video of the Rebbe leaving New York. 20 police cars escorting him. Wow, do they waste taxpayers' money? And then in Israel, the rally, what went on? Wow. The newspapers jump on it. We, the students of REITs, have for a long time hidden our wounds in order that no desecration should take place. But since it has come to this final step, we must publicize the following statement. All right, you know, students know, Bar Maimat Nefesh, you're going to harm the institution. It is known that there is a yeshiva in New York known as Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Chanan. The yeshiva was founded in order to produce great rabbinic scholars who would be acceptable to the people and know the language of the land. Moshe, undenying the language of the land. Unfortunately, however, the yeshiva does not fulfill its purpose. It is true, we have scholars who are brilliant Torah students who are able to lead Orthodox synagogues. But we possess no secular education. When a young man comes to the yeshiva, he is assured that he will be given the best teachers. But after the young man is there for several months, he realizes that he lacks the opportunity to improve himself. And he begins to seek ways to leave the yeshiva. And the statement goes on, but it's a very apt description. This is what I showed you last week, that of the original students, the names we know from the 1890s, out of 10 students, only one went into the rabbinate. Something like five became medical doctors. They went to night school. They learned the language. A Yiddish cup, a good head. Medical doctors. Akiva Matlin, for whom the yeshiva was founded. As I said last week, there should be a plaque when you enter YU in the main academic building. There should be a plaque. This yeshiva was founded because of a teenage kid named Akiva Matlin, whose father wanted him to learn a little Gemara. Knew Akiva Matlin, remember? Went to medical school. Why did Rabbi Klapman find out? Then we actually were able to prove it from other sources. The kid was dissecting bodies, and he was a Kohen. His father got hysterical, brought the kid home. He became an accountant and the controller of a Schlachtheist that his father got him into. But people are, you know, they're not stupid. Some of these people wanted to be Rabbanim, but to be a Rav, you'd have to know the language. This is the 1900s already. There's a second generation on the street. My parents are typical of this generation. They're already caught between two worlds. My father's parents were never Mechallel Shabbos in America. But the kids, their language is English. Okay, we don't know English. Then they say the directors are divided into two groups. One is strictly Orthodox and will permit no study other than Talmud and codes. And the others are more liberal. They think that an elementary school education is good enough. And that comes back time and again, that concept. We speak a little English. We made good money with our English. Your English is good enough for you. You don't need a better English. And you don't have to waste time on Shakespeare and all that literature. And what do you need it for? You just have to know that two and two are four. And that's what counts. These fellas went public. It was the gossip, the talk, the websites of the Greater East Side of New York. The Tageblatt, which was a paper friendly to Torah, not opposed. Editorial. Three types of rabbis are being prepared in America. The students of Cincinnati are one type. The second type are the students at the New York Seminary, JTS, And the third types are the students of Ritz. What was the contribution of Ritz? We needed a yeshiva where our good students, our excellent young men, those who come here with scholarship and the qualities of the old generation and the old world, could become Americanized, cultured, and developed in order that they might become rabbis, possessing both important qualifications, Jewish scholarship and secular knowledge. This need created Ritz. Ritz is necessary only if it prepares for us old country scholars with American attainments. Quote, end quote. My dear students, Moriah Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik could not have said it better. This is spelling out the Rav's Divrei Torah, Ger V'Toshav Anochi Imachem. We live in two worlds. What do you say, Rabbi Rubin?
I would have said a little bit
by my mind. Yeah, go ahead. You can say whatever you wish.
Why was it that Yaakov got the herb to block?
Okay.
He was able to combine being the voice of Jacob.
You are quoting the Rav from the Chamesh Drashot with Rivka and Yaakov. But nevertheless, I go back to the Rav's basic vort, which takes a minute to convey, Ger V'Toshav Anochi Imachem. And this is the reality. It's a reality we have struggled with since the minute we left the ghetto. Today, there's no way you can close this reality out. Even if you live in Williamsburg or Mea Shearim, the big world breathes down your back. And I need not have to illustrate it. You know all the problems we have with Mea Shearim and Williamsburg because everyone is caught up in the drives, the pressures, the values beyond us. Okay, this is why we're here. This is why we struggle. This is why we learn. This is why some of us have a Litvish attitude to succeed. Others have a Hasidic attitude. And Rekefet cries, we need a Rebbe Yisrael Salanta desperately once again. My dear students, these problems are real. You can see, you can feel the angst of the students. You can see the genius of the Talgeblatt, how beautifully they express it. You can see the masses debating the issue. And you can understand, if a guy made a few hundred grand on the Lower East Side with a broken English, it's hard for him to comprehend why rabbis have to know English. Remember the Ritz? He said, if the Rav gets up to speak in English, walk out. I gave you the source, I quoted it. Walk out, quote, end quote. You don't know, this question of language, this battle was fought for 50 years in America. It's not a simple matter. When I told you, look at Rakefet, he's an idiot. Why? Very simple. You cut open Rakefet's mind. He is convinced that Moshe Rabbeinu had gegeben the Torah, had gekrogen the Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam in the Yiddish Sprach. Rakefet is convinced. They taught him that in Lakewood, and he believed it 100%. Not a simple matter. Can we convey Torah in a different language? When I started teaching in Israel, the Israeli programs, 1971, when I left the encyclopedia, went back to teaching full time, can you tell me that the Rabbat is the Ravid? Thus is the Zelba Ravid, the Ravid, the Rabbat? Can you just think for a minute? This is a real problem. Okay, what can I do? I come down on the side of YU, of the students, of my Rebbe, who Danny Greer got him to switch from Yiddish to English. And boy, did we suffer back in 1960-61, the year that Moriah Rebbe switched. Boy, did we suffer with his brilliant English, philosophical English, his interpretation into English of Reb Chaim's terminology, and without batting an eyelash, I think Rabbi Braunschweigel still suffers until today. You check with him. He's down in Lakewood, I'm told, near his children. We grew up together. He's not in the best of health, I understand. God should give him strength. He's a saintly individual. But did he suffer when the Rav, at least we were native English speakers, but he was a greenhorn. He was a survivor. And his whole Torah, you have no idea. By the way, I want to tell you, parentheses, he couldn't believe I remembered this, but how can I forget something like this, even though I heard it so many decades ago. When his Zayda walked into the room, the Gedda Rebbe, Rebbe Avraham Mordechai Alter, stood up for his Zayda. He was the Malamed Dardiki of the world-famous Gedda Rebbe who knew Kol HaTorah Kula Baal Peh, Rebbe Avraham Mordechai Alter, the son of the Sfat Emet. And Abba Brandspiegel Zayda walked into the room, the Gedda Rebbe stood up for him. Okay, unbelievable. But Yiddish is Yiddish, what can we do? My grandchildren, one grandchild, Dafka, I don't know why, when he was in Chorev High School, got permission to learn German, and he went to a special school twice a week, and he mastered German, and he taught for my Talmud, Binny Kraus, in the Lauda program in Frankfurt. Could you imagine? I said, this is why you learn German. You taught Torah. And we speak to each other. I speak to him Yiddish, and he speaks to me German, and we understand each other. But outside of that, all my other grandchildren, and he as well, when they speak Torah, they speak it in the beautiful Ivrit, and it's a whole new world, and the Rabbad is the Rabbad, and the Ravid remains a product of the exile. What did they do? In parentheses, Eli, and I got to tell you, and Moshe, next week, I'm not allowing anyone into class unless you bring one more student. Is there an exam today? What happened? Bina Shalala, material like this, and Yoni, and oh my gosh, it's bad enough yesterday, the Chazonish, oh God. What can I tell you? A prophet has no honor in his own home, but I'm going to tell you this. I'm going into my relative very shortly, and a makpid on my relative's covered. So when I deal with Rabbi Revel, I expect every last fellow from the Kollel here, if he breathes air, if he doesn't breathe, what can I do? Some guys are dead already, even if they're walking on their 10 toenails. What did they do? Okay, so it's very interesting. 1906, they saw, you see, once the newspapers get involved, it affects contributions. Once it affects contributions, they have to do something. So the Balabatim, who were running the yeshiva, turned to Ramaz to come in and be president. Now, who was Ramaz? Ramaz, you all know the name Ramaz School. When you think of Ramaz School, you don't think of the image of the person for whom it's named. Rav Moshe Zvulun Margolis was a Rav of the old school. Long beard, princely clothes, dressed with the big day kahuna, came to America, rabbinated in Boston, from Boston came to New York, becomes rabbi of what is undoubtedly the most influential and prestigious Orthodox synagogue in the Western Hemisphere. Could very well be the most influential, the most prestigious in the entire world outside of Israel. Israel already has some major synagogues, but even with Israel, I don't know. But Kilat Jeshurun, the Upper East Side, remains the Upper East Side until today. It's not an area that went through good periods, bad periods. The West Side is different. There, Harlem overspilled. The West Side was run down. Today, it's regentrified. But KJ has been KJ for well over 115 years already. Now, who founded KJ? These were Balabatim who made it big. These were East European Jews who were able to leave the East Side and move to the prestigious Upper East Side where only wealthy people lived. Many of these Balabatim were Shomer Torah Mitzvot. They made it big and remained from. You have many examples. And they wanted a Rav of the old school. Later in life, they bring in an English-speaking assistant, and that's how Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, I should say rabbi, at that time he was still a frum Jew, that's how Mordechai Kaplan becomes the assistant to Ramaz. Now, Ramaz was revered. This is not just the Rav who, there were Hasidic inclinations. People came to him for advice, for what you would call Das Torah today. People came to him for brachot. He was a first-rate Talmud Chacham. He could paskin a shayla, but he was much more than a Rav. He was revered. He was held in awe. So the feeling was that they could bring him into the yeshiva, and with his presence, he would be able to, if not to end the conflict, but to modify, to ameliorate the tension, the heartache, the mutual enmity that had developed between the students and the Balabatan. And you have to remember, by virtue of the fact that he had been Rav in Boston, that he was now Rav on the Upper East Side, he was a much broader individual than a personage from the Lower East Side. To understand, I'll use a term Tova Lichtenstein taught me. Dr. Tova Soloveitchik Lichtenstein, years ago, we were discussing my Rebbe, her father, and she's also a Talmud of the Rav, and she used the term, her father was a Brahmin. So I looked at her, Brahmin is in India, you know, the caste system. So she said, you look it up near the unabridged, you'll see it means someone who believes that, for instance, New England is the greatest place in the world. And the Rav really believed that New England was the greatest place in the world. He said it publicly. I once heard him in a drusha in the 50s. He said when he gets on the plane going back to Boston, he's the happiest man. He says, in New York, it's like a zoo. And everyone eats each other one up. And you have lions and tigers. But you go back to Boston, he said, there it's cultured. It's a different environment altogether, much more tolerant, etc., etc. Okay? The Rav really was a Brahmin. You all know that. The reason that Danny Greer was able to, why was he able to get the Rav to switch languages? Because I was sitting right here, and Danny Greer's, the Rav is here, I'm here, and Danny Greer's there. And Danny Greer says to the Rav, Rebbe, I'm a Princeton graduate, and I've taken off a year to learn Torah, and you don't allow me to learn Torah. And the Rav, right, a Princeton graduate? That was it. All the doors were open for Danny Greer, Ivy League College. You got to understand the Rav. Rabbi Margolis had this veneer, had this polish. His outlook was broad. So it was viewed, this is what I believe. Klapman doesn't spell it out, but knowing Ramaz and why they brought him in, I would say that the Balabatim hoped that the man's prestige, awe, reverence, and his broadness would ameliorate the situation. Well, the truth is, he came in, but again, it's only part-time. He didn't know the ins and outs of America. It didn't really bring salvation. And then they pulled the usual shtick that is pulled in yeshiva, and continues until today, if you know some of the machlekes and Panovich and elsewhere. Suddenly they don't have enough money. They decide to throw out 15 students. Now, you have to understand, what does this mean, they don't have enough money? Yeshivot were built upon one principle, support. Every student who went to yeshiva got support. Read the memoir literature of Volozhin. Read the memoir literature of Mir. Now, it's true. Many of the outsiders who came into Mir from Germany, from America, when Mir became world famous in the interbellum period between World War I to World War II, many of them did not need support. But the European student who went to Volozhin, who went to Mir, who went to Slabatka, How did the Rosh Yeshiva control the students? Because a committee would meet, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mashgiach. How much do you get per month? 5 ruble, 3 ruble. So students had to behave. Students had to attend shiurim. You couldn't cut wholesale. There was attendance taken. The Mashgiach knew what was going on. And rubles, same thing with YU. YU, every student got support. I remember in my time, 51, when I came in, how many students got meal tickets? How many students got clothes? I remember before Pesach, before Rosh Hashanah, any kid who needed a suit, who needed shoes, you would tell Din Zar, and he would arrange. You would go down to manufacturers from Jews who manufactured clothes, who manufactured shoes, and every kid was clothed. We're a wonderful people. I mean, we forget sometimes with all the machlekes, we forget what a wonderful people. Mikamcha Yisrael, Goy Chadorot. What does HaKadosh Baruch have in his tefillin? No, right or wrong. Mikamcha Yisrael, God. We have Shema Yisrael, Shemekam Hashemachad. And the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, Mikamcha Yisrael, God. It's a beautiful chazal. We forget how good we are. So they decide to cut 15 students. Who were the 15 students they cut? The troublemakers. The ones that are agitating against the yeshiva. And once again, it is brought into the open, the machloket, the yelling, the shouting. Then this will explain to you why in 1907, evidently three of the top students were meraglim, ahead of the kehila. They made a foray, we'll call it that, use of a military terminology, and they went to the seminary. What will Rabbi Solomon Schechter do for them? And you can understand it. But 1908, now already the problem breaks out. Bugadol, loud and clear. Now, coming back to Solomon Schechter, just for your historic understanding and how they could go to Solomon Schechter. So I want to tell you, when Reb Lazer Silva decided to, you know, when he came to America, Reb Lazer Silva is a very, very fascinating story. We'll deal with him next year. It's not for now. But just to tell you briefly, you're talking about the son of a big community, Reb Yunim Silva, was a big kehila in Litta, and he's the son of the Rav, the Dushtat the Rav, and he's learning in the Kollel, in the kibbutz, who is called Reb Chaim Moshe. And you have to say, this is not like Gris Kollel, with all due respect to Gris. This was a Kollel. Everyone who studied in that Kollel became a Gadol b'Yisrael. This was a kibbutz around Reb Chaim Moshe, Gedolei Gedolei Olam. So in Vilna, he also went into the Strashun Library. Remember I told you about it a few months ago, Strashun Library a few weeks ago. And that was the library of all the Svarim in Vilna, was the top library. And there was a young woman behind the desk, was the librarian. And he fell in love with her. She was, I'm told, a beautiful woman. She died young, Nebuch. And that four children after. So, no, you marry not a shidduch. He already was not fit for Europe. So he figured, the hell with Europe. He got another blaze of silver. He moved on to America. I'm finished. So he comes to America, he had relatives here. I think it was 1907, whatever. Comes to America, and he decides to go into the insurance business. He had relatives, wants to make a living. So he didn't succeed. His relatives told him, it's not for you, the insurance. Maybe it was 1906 he came. I think 1907, he takes a shteller in Harrisburg. But at a certain point, he went to see Solomon Schechter too. And according to Reb David Leib Silva, he said he had a very nice meeting. His father told him, but one thing I understood, that Solomon Schechter, he says, was sitting there without a yarmulke. He only put the yarmulke around when he looked at a source. You know, like the Germans, Rav Hirsch, others. So he said, that the seminary is not for him. Then, years later, when Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner came to America. Who did he go to see? Who wrote a letter of introduction for him? This already was Louis Ginsberg. He went to see Professor Ginsberg at the seminary. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik wrote a letter of introduction for Rav Yitzchak Kuttner to see, asking Louis Ginsberg, Professor Louis Ginsberg, who was a Gaon Adir, you understand? They all knew him from Europe and Ilui Mufak. And he went to see Professor Ginsberg. Now, we don't know exactly what, but you don't have to be a big genius. He probably was looking for a place to hang his hat, probably looking for a position. Now, this letter, or this correspondence, was produced by my student, Rabbi Dr. Mark Shapiro. So you can find it on his blogs, whatever. But you see, the seminary, it's not the seminary of today. That's what you have to realize. That the seminary in Tul, the 1950s, in Tul the Tshuva on being able to drive to synagogue or to temple on Shabbat, in Tul that Tshuva appeared, that already represents the break between Torah and the seminary. And from that point on, you're not going to find a Europeisha Talmud Chacham going to see a Rabbi a Professor Finkelstein for a job at the seminary. But until the early 50s, the breach was not that great. The chasm was not that deep. And this is why they went to Salomon Schechter, but it didn't succeed. It didn't succeed, and the situation at the yeshiva remained horrendous. And in 1908, a tremendous strike broke out. The young men said, it is the old story of the battle against worldly knowledge that the directors have been waging against us. We want the yeshiva to be a real educational institution for American rabbis. But they look upon it as a charity, listen to these words carefully, as a charity institution to provide us with food that we might study Torah for them. You see? Yisachar Zvulun. If you sign a Yisachar Zvulun relationship with a student in Lakewood, and then you find out the guy in Lakewood is knocking off of one of the Sturim every day to go to a chveis to take open university classes, you're going to be very upset. I'm paying you money. You should sit and learn. I can't sit and learn. I'm busy out there making money. I'm busy in real estate. I'm busy with the stock market. I got to listen to the news every 15 minutes. I got to know which way to go with the stocks. You ever see? I mean, I've been in places where they're playing games and it's flashing and the screens are flashing and they're in touch with the whole world. And all right, I'm paying you to learn. What are you doing? That's it. That line is fabulous. A charity institution to provide us with food that we may study Torah for them. But look what the students want. We demand the systematic teaching of Jewish and general knowledge, a better administration, and consequently, that the board of directors should be reorganized. We want to produce rabbis who will be a source of pride for Jewry in America. Wow. The New York newspapers, the Yiddish press, stands behind the students. 100%. Putting aside the Cincinnati Reform Factory, that's what the Tageblatt calls Hebrew Union College, there remains the competition between Schechter's rabbinical school and Reitz. Schechter's seminary, according to the intent of the founders and supporters of Reitz, is Jewish, but not religious enough. And here we come to the conflict of the yeshiva students and the leaders of Reitz. We want, claim the students, to know Talmud and codes better than the students of Schechter Seminary. We want to know all the material that the rabbis of Russia do. But we want to have as much secular education as the students of Schechter's. We cannot be satisfied with the bit of English that the administration permits us to study. And the administration thinks this way: a rabbi is neither obligated to study nor requires too much secular knowledge. Too much secular knowledge conflicts with Judaism. It is quite sufficient for a rabbi to be able to talk English and to be able to answer in English. And you see the heart of the conflict. And boy, 100 years later, we still live with these problems. Yes, Ellie.
Didn't you say that seminary did not have secular education?
Well, it means they required them to go to university. They had to have a university. They wanted to have it within the yeshiva. They wanted more basic. They wanted a high school. These were kids who were 18, 19, and then had arrived at 14. They want a high school degree. But the seminary, you had to have your high school, college. They didn't require a doctorate. It's not like the European schools, but the European schools required a doctorate. By the way, I can tell you in parentheses, it was easier to get a doctorate in Europe. In other words, the requirements that the Rebbe had to go through to get a doctorate, or people who studied in Berlin at universities at that time, it's not as detailed as the requirements you have today. What they did have that we don't have is they had to know Latin, Greek and Latin. That was a sine qua non requirement for any advanced degree in the humanities. But outside of that, it wasn't like a bachelor's, a master's, and then a doctorate. You could, with an equivalency degree of gymnasium, which was more than a high school, but it's not that a college degree, you could go into a program that led to a doctorate. So it was easier for the seminaries to require a PhD, but the seminary in America did not. Okay. Let me end off the class. What happened in 1908? Yeah, what happened in 1910? Now the board of directors got more serious. And once again, you'll see the problem. It's also a problem that haunted YU recently in modern times. There was one rabbi in the American scene, and only one, who was considered the most Americanized of the Europäische Rabbanim. He knew America inside out. He spoke English. He read English. His outlook was totally broad. His name, and some of you are related to him, Harav Dov Aryeh HaKohen Leventhal. His great-great-grandson-in-law is sitting here. Do I have it right? Do I have enough greats? Okay. We had the Brit and the Kollel of his great-great-great-great-grandson, if I have it right. Okay. And you know, the shy little kids ask me about naming him. I always laugh, but okay. You have to... Reb Dov Aryeh HaKohen Leventhal was a Europäische Rav. Yeah, and again, you know, some Jewish kids are born with very good minds, whether it's inborn or whether nurture, we'll leave that to anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists to deal with. But generally speaking, what was his name? Romney. When Mitt Romney spoke at Tisha B'Av time in Yerushalayim, he hit the nail on the head. It could be it's a result of persecution, could be people of a simple nature take the easy way out and throw their Judaism away. Those who remain Jewish over the generations are the brighter people. And therefore, you pass on and we become, it's the trait that we have selected that we perpetuate. There were a lot of bright individuals, and they centered around Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan Spector for smicho. Now, what does that mean? And let me explain myself. You're going to hear a lot of times people will say to you, they got smicho from Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan. You read about it, you know, you do your studies when you do research. So you'll say, Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan, what yeshiva did he run? He didn't run a yeshiva, it was Shtat Rav of Kafna. Generally speaking, yeshiva did not give smicho. When you were ready to study, they gave you a plan of study, or you knew from your friends. Then you went for exams. Reb Yitzchok Chanan was a very big masmech. The truth is, his smicha was not worth as much as a YU smicha. They tell about Reb Yitzchok Chanan that he once wrote a whole haskama from a book, Harav, Hagon, etc., etc., and then he left about 10 lines blank and signed. So they said, Rebbe, this happens to be, they claim, a true story. It's documented in a doctrine of Bitzal Chanan by a professor, by a friend, Rabbi Dr. Ephraim Shimov, says, upon a Levracha. So they asked him, Rebbe, why did you leave 10 blank lines? So he said, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. Okay? So he gave endless smicha, but there was a reason behind it. He was asked, how come your exams are not as, other people, if you wanted to get smicha, you had to stay in the house of the Rav for a week and speak and learning and all kolach Torah kula, you had to pass in shilas in front of him. So Mitzchanan, first of all, didn't have time for that. But secondly, he said, look, these Rabbanim are going to America, they're going to England, they're going... This way, if I give them smicha, they will have a contact with me. It will be good for the Jewish people. And it was very insightful. And Reb Dov Ayakon Leventhal had smicha with Chanan, and many others had smicha. He wound up in Philadelphia. And he owned the city. Philadelphia was a Zeran pin of the Lower East Side. My family... Four Rothkopf brothers came to America. My Zeta winds up on the Lower East Side. Two of his brothers wind up in Philadelphia. A fourth brother, who was a Rav, a Sheikhet, I think became a Sheikhet in America, winds up in Massachusetts, in Taunton, New Bedford. I write about him in Washington. That was my great uncle. But two of my Zeta's brothers wound up in Philadelphia. There were hundreds of thousands of East European Jews who wound up in Philadelphia. South Philly, Strawberry Mansion, those of you who know Philadelphia, these were like the Lower East Side. Rav Leventhal was revered, but he was much more open-minded than any Rav in New York could be. Because when all is said and done, Philadelphia is already in the West. It's not New York City. You already have to be broader. And he was there 10 years, and he was there 20 years, and he spoke the language, and he read a newspaper. His children, as you know, one went on to become a very famous judge in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, and one went on to become one of the most famous conservative rabbis, although he in his personal life was a total Shomer Torah mitzvah, but he was the Rav of Brooklyn Jewish Center. That was his son, and that was the top synagogue in New York City, plain and simple. When the sixth Rebbe came to America, and again, I have to be very brief, and the Balabatan told him, Rebbe, you're retired, there's nothing you can do in America. This was in the hotel on the Upper West Side. I have it in my notes when I worked it out on the Rebbe, exactly the hotel. And so the Rebbe wakes up the next morning, calls him the Chassidim, and he says, where I come from, a Rebbe tells Chassidim what to do, not vice versa. He says, I'm going to rest 2 weeks, and then I'm starting all over in Chavetz Weiss, and as America is nicht anders for the alte Heim. I'm going to show that America is not different than the old home. And then he asked the Chassidim, how do we know which is the... I want to start a shtibble in the top area of New York. So some of the Balabatim were ready, where there was Liebman, there was Kramer, these were top Balabatim who had conquered America. You know the Kramer family, part of it is in Lawrence, etc. And Lieberman family, Liebman lived in, and these were top Balabatim who knew him. They said, you want to know the best neighborhood? You got to look where the top conservative temple is. And that's why they went to Eastern Parkway. Eastern Parkway is like the Grand Concourse of New York, even more, Prospect Park. And here you have Brooklyn Jewish Center. And that's how the Rebbe began there. And of course, you know, today Brooklyn Jewish Center is a big Lubavitch educational institution. And what remains of the Balabatim of Brooklyn Jewish Center are big supporters. Lubavitch has a way that they brought. I went for an interview with one of them, and he says, well, I don't agree with everything, but with that, this was a judge, I believe, or a famous doctor. It was a famous doctor speaking who had grown up in Brooklyn Jewish Center. So I don't agree with everything, but you got to give Lubavitch credit. They are perpetuating Judaism. So they brought Bernard Leventhal to become president and Rosh Yeshiva. This was the dream. This was the agreement. They felt that he would accomplish more than Ramaz. He would understand the students. He would do something for the yeshiva that perhaps could salvage the enmity, the hard feeling, could change it, minimize it, and bring about this vision of Europäische Rabbanim who know how to learn but have the language of the United States. Gentlemen, where do we go from here? You'll see what the problem was with Rabbi Leventhal. It's interesting what happens afterwards. And then, believe it or not, I will be lecturing on my own cousin. It's a schut. Let me reiterate, what did we do today? And Ellie, I'm dead serious. You don't come into class next week. I don't want your father and uncle. I want them on their own. You got to bring in one student by the year. I can't believe this. Your history. What are we talking about? Yoni, got it? Tie your payas around the ear of the fellow you're bringing in. And bau kacha, ya'aneh amen. Moshe, if you come with your wife, she can, it's okay. If not, another student. You gotta know what nice, what fabulous young men we have here. Okay? Moshe is voting tomorrow. Need I say more? His wife is voting tomorrow. I have a feeling we're all goyim, but we're gonna be very happy. You don't realize the miracle of this election. My brother and I were just talking. We don't even know Bennett. And our children, our grandchildren, are so enthused. From our family alone, he has 100 to nothing. 100 votes for Bennett, zero for any other party. From my family alone, this is without exaggeration. My brother's not like me. He has endless. I have a big family. He has a gigantic family. And you know what's going to be in 50 years for my brother's family? Thousands. My family, his family. John, what did we do today? Yitzchak, I conveyed the information to Chicago. Remember what I asked you yesterday? So I gave them information and who to contact already. I checked it out. Yeah. I gave them a name already, too. So, Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, what did we do today? We picked up exactly where we left off last week. And all right, I'll make a compromise with Yitzchak and with Satma. He was a split personality. Jacob Schiff.
If you bring him in the book. He came once to visit Greece.
Right, the Rav, it's not me. The Rav said that. I don't know whether it's true.
Right.
Rav Aronovich was teaching Yoredeya. And I don't like a place where they teach only about stomachs. I don't believe it was Jacob Schiff. I think the Rav made a mistake with the name. You follow me? But I can't say anything. I'm quoting the Rav. The greatness of my two volumes on the Rav is that there's no Rakefet in it. It's the Rav net. You follow? Today, it's 12 years after the book first appeared. Zachite. You have no idea what the hell. Don't want to say a word, but Gedolei Yisrael have said nice things about those two volumes. Who knew the Rav. But I believe the Rav made a mistake. You know, to the Rav's mind, who do you have? Jacob Schiff? There were other Balabatim who had money, who might have been interested. But you're absolutely right.
What you're mentioning, the landlords were not exactly 100% Orthodox if they supported
it. The family had a split. It's not all the landlords. The family had a split. Go to the website, you'll see. That's documented 100%. Family had a split. So, very fascinating.
They had a problem with it.
What?
One of those who wanted to get rid of Mordechai Kaplan. And there were people like Milton Steinberg who said, if that's the case, our synagogue stops its contribution.
No, I understand. That's why they couldn't get rid of Mordechai Kaplan. He had heavy support, financial, but money talks. Balabatim are interested in ideas, but money? Come on, money speaks. Mordechai Kaplan had every support. You could not get rid of him. And I showed that in my postdoctoral research with documents that speak. They had no solution. And why you, even the most open-minded element in Reitz, couldn't swallow Mordechai Kaplan. Even the most, others were opposed, why do we need scientific rabbinic training? Where are you to pay a shot? That they would have solved. All the shirim would have been yeshivish. But there would have been a postgraduate division, which you have today with Bernard Drevel. You follow? That you could have had with the seminary. Would have solved the whole problem. But Mordechai Kaplan was the bone in the throat. And by 1925, he was too famous. 1915, you could have gotten rid of him. 1925, he was Mordechai Kaplan. Professor Kaplan, 1932. Judaism as a civilization. The greatest story of Mordechai Kaplan is when he's walking on the... This I know from people who were there. He's walking on the west side, and it's raining. And he's walking with an umbrella. And they say to him, Professor Kaplan, you don't carry on Shabbos. You wear your handkerchief. He used to show his handkerchiefs around his neck. My father did it that way. This is the Jewish civilization. So they said, how can you carry an umbrella? He said, for a civilization, you don't get sick. Follow? That's Mordechai Kaplan. With Louis Ginsberg, they tell a story again. This may be anecdotal with Louis Ginsberg because he was firm in his personal life. But they say he comes out of the elevator Shabbos. So a balabas says, Professor Ginsberg, I asked you about, you said you can't use the Shabbos. How do you go into it? He says, you asked, I didn't. That's what they say about Mordechai, about Louis Ginsberg. But I don't know. His son, if you read the son's memoir, you already understand that in his old age he had regret that he had gone so far, because he was really an adam gadol in learning. Oh, we're going to talk about it in our Sunday class. We're going to reach a dilemma with you'll see next week. I'll show you a dilemma. How do you handle it? Okay. Gentlemen, fascinating. 1906, 1907, 1908. We have Ramaz, Shechter, Reb Dov Aryeh Cohen Leventhal. We haven't finished with Rav Leventhal. That's next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. I wouldn't miss Sunday Shia for all the ballots that are going to be cast on Tuesday. Two gifts. If anyone wants, this today is a collector's item. It's the 1,000th issue of Torah Tidbits. It has, on every Pasha of the week, you have a nice Devar Torah. So, if anyone is interested, it's yours for the taking. This supports what I've said, that women today, getting involved in halacha, they can do things that I don't think any man is capable of. And here I'm holding in front of me Dr. Chava Yael Schreiber, MD. I don't know who she is. I think I met her in the office, Xeroxing copies of this, and I asked her, made a copy for me. And I can't get over what she has here. This deals with a problem that haunts us as rabbis and as human beings. A woman who is menstruant during her wedding. And the whole problem, let alone the Sadeh Kedushin, Yesham Milismoch already, even though it's Lavri Labila, but it's very embarrassing. They can't go home together, they can't be mityached. And here she has an entire article with medical charts, what medicine or hormones to adjust and how to take it, when to take it, when to start taking it. And I have to tell you, when I saw this article, I don't understand it entirely because it's, I have to give it to my grandson who's in medical school and see if he understands it. But I want to tell you, Ashrei Ayin Ra'ata Zat. My dear friends, those of you that are voting tomorrow, may it be an intelligent vote. And until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danyer. I thank all the guests who were here this week. Are you still here next week? You have to go back and get back to the grindstone, okay? Baruch Hashem. And you have to go back. You're on Passaic, am I correct? Passaic. Still have Jews there.
Still? No, it's the second column.
But one second.
There are very few who are still from the...
But I want to ask you about...
Where my mother grew up.
But I want to tell you, with Passaic, the gimmick that you have separate hours for men and separate hours for women, I don't have to worry about with the food stores.
In another year or two, maybe.
Another year or two.
We're heading there.
You don't know how seriously people took that prune joke. You follow me? This is where the world is today. As men can gleben, as thus can sein. But what can I tell you? And Rabbi Hertz, you also go back to the Golah. Where do you teach? You teach in Hafta. Okay, so part of your faculty have to be students of mine. So send all best regards, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart by honoring me with your presence. Kol Tov Selah. Now, where did Danny disappear?
That's a wonderful question.